And happy May Day to all of you who work, all of you who have any relationship to work, whether it's in the home or private or with bosses or however you're doing your life. This is our May Day. Let's reclaim it. There's a lot of things happening today, and I am so honored to be part of that. I have on the line with me Sean Richmond. He is the author of Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. Sean Richmond spent a decade and a half as a union organizer and representative. He's the program director of the Harry Van Arsdale Jr. School of Labor Studies at SUNY Empire State College. His writing has been published in the American Prospect, In These Times, Jacobin, the New York Daily News, and the New York Times. He has been involved in a lot of labor struggles, and he's also the author of the Labor's Bill of Rights. And thank you so much for being with me today, Sean. You there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, sorry I didn't let you get your tea there.
I got my tea. We're good.
You got your tea. Yes. And so this book was an important one for me because I learned so much, and of course it's kind of in one ear and out the other with me a little bit these days, but you say that less than 11% of workers are unionized, and that a lot of people would like to be in a union, and that's my take too, is that that people pretty much love unions. I mean, some people have bad opinions about unions.
Yeah, the bosses are not generally.
Yeah, the bosses. But the bosses don't like them. But the people do. So a little history of the labor movement and about May Day and why it's important that we think of ourselves as workers on this day.
Oh, gosh. I mean, we're going all the way back to 1886, I guess.
We don't have much time for it, though.
I do think that a lot of us lost an identity as workers and as a working class in sort of the latter half of the 20th century. And a lot of that is sort of media directed, and a lot of that is the labor movement being a victim of its own success. You know, it actually improved, really substantially improved, wages and benefits for a lot of workers back when unions represented one third of all workers in the country, and most employers felt that they had to match the benefits, even for non-union workers, in order to keep the unions out. A lot of people convinced ourselves that we were middle class, and we weren't. We're working class. Where, you know, it really comes down to do you own the factory? Do you own the place that you go to work? Do you own your own tools, or are you following somebody else's orders? And most of us are following somebody else's orders. And I guess what I'm trying to get at in my book is that labor's success, which is largely born out of the New Deal. And out of a World War II and a post World War accord that sort of set, that where employers finally, after a very bloody history in this country of resisting workers' attempts to form unions, agreed that unions could have a role in society and that workers did deserve more of a share of the success, but that. The structure of that and a lot of the choices that were made in crafting the laws that are sort of the safety net of worker protection and worker rights were a series of historical accidents and are so outdated, and we're seeing it in this pandemic crisis, just how shabbily treated the vast majority of working people and the vast majority of Americans are working people are being treated, because the system really relies upon a very stable relationship between an employer and an employee and sort of assumes a 30-year career, et cetera. And employers have spent basically the 1970s until now trying to secede from that system through offshoring, through subcontracting, through freelancing, and through just outright union busting. And as a result, most workers are on their own unless they can organize with their coworkers in a sort of a wildcat fashion, which we're seeing in really amazing ways, and I wish we knew more of what was going on in the places where people are still reporting for work because they're deemed essential.
Yeah. So this is not been a booming economy in terms of what the workers experience, because hardly anybody has enough money to miss two paychecks, as we have found out now with, what is it, like 30 million filing for unemployment in the last 6 weeks.
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit about this whole idea that everything was great before the pandemic?
Yeah, no, things were clearly not great, and it really, I mean, it's a real parallel to the Great Depression as well, where like in the the narrative on the 1920s, you know, at least the media narrative at the time, and a lot of the historical narrative since, is that the 20s were great. It was booming, it was roaring, etc. And then, you know, the stock market crashed, and the stock market crash is just the thing that pushed the entire economy over the edge for everybody else. The 1920s were lousy for most working Americans. Wages stagnated. Wages actually went backwards. There was a strike wave in 1918, 1919 during a pandemic, and I'm not sure what the connection is there. But it led to unions representing a much larger proportion of the workforce. It led to a lot of wage increases and a lot of improvements in reducing hours and all that kind of stuff. And then the employers spent the post-war depression years cutting everything back and basically robbing. You know, it was a great time to be an investor. It was a great time to be sitting on wealth, because wealth made more wealth more quickly than workers could make money. That's sort of where we're at, right? Like a lot of us were getting by on credit cards and second mortgages and loans from 401ks, and I'm in this boat as well. I mean, I'm up to my ears in debt. It hasn't been a great economy. I think the real struggle and the real question of the moment is, you know, what the next new normal looks like. And for most of us, like, we just have to recognize it that, you know, 5 years ago, the year 2015, before Trump, it was a lousy year for most people in this country. It was a lousy year. Most of us were crushed by debt. Most of us were working we were either working too many hours or not enough hours. In either case, not making enough money. And that's all born of our utterly broken labor protection system in this country.
Yeah. And I think the question in everyone's mind is about what will happen next. Can the coronavirus and the vast unemployment of workers lead to any kind of labor law reform in this country, or revolution that would, because there is a crisis in capitalism now, a depression, do you have any hope at all about how this might shift out if people organize?
I do. I wrote my book with both a sense of frustration and a sense of hope. One of the things I was really trying to draw attention to is I think that we on the left are sometimes trapped by our own sense of history. Mm-hmm. And there's this thing that we tell ourselves that nothing's going to get better unless we start having sit-down strikes, unless there's a strike wave. And if you look at the history of the New Deal, first of all, there wasn't one New Deal. There were two New Deals.
Right.
Roosevelt came to office with a very different approach to the economic crisis, a much more pro-business approach that dealt unions in a little bit, but was really much more attuned to business interests. And it's really around 1935 that the New Deal takes a more pro-labor stance. But labor was dealt into those early New Deal bills. I'm thinking of the National Industrial Recovery Act, which guaranteed a quote-unquote right to organize for workers, Section 7A. No enforcement mechanism for this whatsoever. Not worth the paper it was written on. But did just enough to raise the expectations of a lot of workers and then dash their hopes that it actually did trigger a strike wave. And so in the year 2020, I am actually convinced, and as dispirited as I am at the prospect of a Joe Biden nomination, Mm-hmm. I'm still convinced that there are enough power brokers in the Democratic Party who recognize the fundamental fact of the reason they keep losing midterm elections, the reason that, that Trump can win, the reason that George W. Bush could win, is that the Republicans have understood better than the Democrats have for too long that, that labor unions are what drive out the vote for Democrats, and that the decline of unionization from 33% down to 11% is an existential threat to Democrats ever getting into office again, and that if they can win the White House and the Senate, that they got to do some stuff fast to put money in workers' pockets, to give them some more protections, and to encourage them to organize and to challenge their bosses. I'm still convinced that's the case. To be perfectly frank, Biden was the worst of the possible choices among a very rich field of candidates. So we are going to have to go on strike once we all get back to work. It's a rich moment. It's a moment that's rich with possibilities, but we're not looking for saviors right now. We need to be looking to ourselves as each other's protectors.
You mentioned strikes, and in your book it becomes really clear that a lot of, in collective bargaining, there's a lot of no-strike clauses that have pretty much kneecapped workers from being able to have much clout. But right now there's a general strike going on that is pretty widespread. It's in at Target, Walmart, Instacart, Amazon, etc., and people are being asked to ask not to shop at those places today. And then also, workers were going to be walking out at noon. What's the difference between a regular labor strike and something that is just sort of? I don't think this is natural, but it's caused by the situation that we have with the COVID.
So one of the problems with the labor relations framework that developed is that strikes became heavily regulated and heavily routinized. And there are all kinds of laws about what a union can and cannot do during a strike, with significant financial penalties. I think this is the thing that people really have to appreciate. If a union breaks the law in a strike, and breaking the law is basically engaging in acts of solidarity activism. The Oreo workers in Chicago got locked out, and the jobs were sent to Mexico 2 years ago, maybe. What you would think should happen in terms of solidarity is that the grocery store workers, represented by United Food and Commercial Workers, would say, we're not going to put Oreos on the shelves. We're going to go on strike if you put Oreos in the store. Mm-hmm. That would be a completely reasonable act of solidarity under those circumstances. It would also be so illegal that Nabisco could sue the union for triple whatever they claim the financial damages are, which, they would claim it's billions of dollars and the union would go out of business. And they get to go right to the courts. If a union has a complaint about the employer breaking the law, they have to go through a series of steps in front of Trump-appointed officials who don't really give a crap. An employer can go right to the courts and get a judge to say, yep, they have to pay you $500 million tomorrow, and that union is out, is just gone. It doesn't exist. That's crushing. That's utterly crushing, and that is a part of the problem that we have. And the other part of the problem that we've had, which this is where things are getting better, is strikes are contagious, if you'll forgive the analogy under the current circumstances. You need to see somebody else do it and walk away from the situation, not blacklisted and fired or whatever, whether they won an improvement or not, but just the act of going on strike and then returning to the job at some point with your head held high, you see that. You see someone else do that. You get the idea that maybe you should do it at your own workplace. And the problem that we had, from 1982 until 2 years ago, was most people saw strikes as a losing battle, because they were losing battles, because so many of these anti-union, anti-strike rules, laws, had built up to the point where unions had a very difficult time, official legal unions had a very difficult time going on official legal strikes. Now, the teachers unions, the Fight for 15, you've seen a lot of strikes. A lot of teachers union strikes were technically illegal. And a lot of the wildcat actions that are happening at these completely non-union, there's no official legal union at Instacart or Amazon or any of these places. Mm. But the workers are going on strike because the workers just themselves are looking at each other and saying, this is a messed up situation and I'm leaving and you should leave with me. And they got the idea because they watched the Chicago teachers go on strike. They watched the fast food workers go on strike. They watched the teachers go on, the West Virginia teachers go on strike. And so that is very interesting that striking is now a thing that ordinary non-union workers are thinking about. What the economy looks like when, society quote unquote opens up. I don't know. I'm a little bit worried that the people that are learning how to strike are going to wound up laid off in the winter. But whenever we get back to work, we've all learned some really important lessons about how to go on strike and when to go on strike. And the bosses are going to regret that, I hope.
Yeah. You say it is the visible resistance of organized workers that inspires people to join the labor movement. And perhaps there'll be a big bump in labor organizing, but there's a lot of labor law reform that's needed. So if the Democrats win, and you had your wish list, what would be like three things that they could do for workers?
So at the top of my wish list is a just cause law. Just cause is the principle that you can't be fired unless it's for a good documented work-related performance reason. And in the U.S. we have a judge-made law called at will, which is you could be fired for a bad reason, no reason at all. And that's just what it is. And your equivalent right is you can quit at any time. Awesome. Cool. That's I'll quit. And I'm sure the landlord will respect my stand there. And this is a very American thing. Throughout most of the industrialized world, there are laws on the books that spell out what is an appropriate termination or not. We have special carved out protections. And the system doesn't work because the onus is on the employee to prove that she was terminated because she was pregnant, because she was 42 years old, because she was black, because she was gay. And the employer just gets to sit back and be like, no, it's this other reason instead. And partly in America, it's because unions negotiate just cause into their contracts. And I think there's a lot of union members and a lot of union leaders who sort of like that being this union advantage. You get a union in order to get your job protections. But I think the very clear reality is unless workers feel like they are protected, they're not going to go on strike as much as they should. They're not going to protest as much as they should. They're not going to say no to completely unrelated job tasks like, get my dry cleaning or come up to my hotel room, Matt Lauer. So just cause is, I would put that at the top of the list of things that even, there's all kinds of stuff we got to work out about, what are the enforcement mechanisms, what's the recourse, fine. But also, again, even if you say it's the law and there's no protections for it, there's something about raising expectations and then dashing hope. So I would put just cause at the top of the list. Number two, we got to get out of the framework of workplace-based unionization, of what's called enterprise bargaining in nerd speak. The idea that you only have a union if workers at your specific workplace voted for a union sometime decades ago and negotiated a contract, and somehow you haven't been locked out and that contract hasn't been torn up. This is the system that employers are evading by offshoring and subcontracting and freelancing. We need a system that says there's going to be a union in every workplace in America now, day one. The workers can decide whether they want to join and pay dues or not, but there's going to be a representation in effect. And that could be anything from, we should look at Germany and their works council model, which is a sort of a workplace-based thing where, there is a workplace government in place. Unions are a political party within it, but the employer has to deal with worker representatives. Or we could look at wage boards, which is an old idea from the New Deal that's getting revived lately. That's how the fast food workers in New York State won the $15 minimum wage, was through a sort of a tripartite board, representative of the industry, representative of the workers, representative of the public. and discuss what is a fair wage for the workers. That's a model we got to get to. And then we do actually have to amend the National Labor Relations Act. There is a bill that is sitting out there called, it's called the PRO Act. It's good. It repeals much of the 1947 anti-union Taft-Hartley law. That's a big part of the trap that we're stuck in. But we got to go further. We need language in there that basically overturns every bad court decision on labor law. And Congress actually has the power to overturn bad labor law, because bad labor law is the result of judges acting like legislators. Congress can put language in a bill that says, we're the legislators, you're the judges, we're overturning everything you said, and by the way, we don't ever want you ruling on this again. I'd like to see progressive Democrats get a bit tougher in their legislative drafting, because judge-made law and the weaponized First Amendment are going to kill us unless Congress says, back off, this is our job.
Hmm. Yeah, you wrote that unions are hampered by rules that would never be applied to corporations or to any other form of political action. Basically, this Commerce Clause, I think, is what started us down the wrong path, and it makes it so that workers are really constrained.
Yeah, so the Supreme Court spent the first couple of years of FDR's administration overturning everything because they just didn't want the government to be involved in the private marketplace. And so there was a real debate about what the National Labor Relations Act should be pegged to constitutionally because the Supreme Court was determined to overturn it. There was a crusty old seaman in the American Federation of Labor named Andrew Ferousis, who was insisting it should be based on the 13th Amendment, which might sound crazy to modern ears, but the 13th Amendment says not only that slavery is against the law, but involuntary servitude. You don't insert words into the Constitution willy-nilly. That was put there intentionally because there were labor unions in 1865, white workers, who were also chafing under wage labor, which they were calling wage slavery, and this was a way of sort of satisfying them in addition to freeing the black chattel slaves after the war. And so labor spent the rest of the 19th century saying, hey, the 13th Amendment means the employers can't do this, the employers can't do that. And so the American Federation of Labor was saying, you know, yes, we should root this act in the 13th Amendment. Like, you know, if Abraham Lincoln was alive right now, if he looked at what's going on around here, he would say, what the hell? I thought we made this illegal. But the progressives on the other side, aligned with, you know, just a pragmatic approach, they decided, let's go for the narrow Commerce Clause, which is, you know, there's language in the Constitution that says Congress has the authority to regulate commerce between the states. And let's just do that and hope that that gets passed the Congress. And in reality, the law got passed Congress in 1937 because of the sit-down strikes that happened in 1937, because of the raising expectations and dashing hopes that had happened. And our modern reality is, when employers challenge labor law and say, we should be allowed to do this awful thing to workers because they're going in there saying, it's our First Amendment right, it's our 14th Amendment right, you know, all this stuff. And we're stuck saying, well, the National Labor Relations Act is constitutional because of the Commerce Clause, and the Act says that you should defer to the authority of the NLRB. And it's the weakest argument on earth. The Commerce Clause is no match for the weaponized First Amendment. And so through Labor's Bill of Rights and through this book, I've been arguing we need to be asserting a progressive constitutional theory of workers' rights, which is not just the 13th Amendment, I think. I think there's a First Amendment right. You know, the First Amendment has, you know, we talk about free speech, but it also talks about free assembly. What is a union if not an active expression of the freedom to assemble and protest? The Fifth Amendment has, you know, due process. The founding fathers who wrote that thing, they didn't have a concept of a private sector and a public sector. They thought due process was a right that you should have as a member of society, period, full stop. We should revive that. The 13th Amendment, the 14th Amendment right of equal protection, all of that, we should be actively asserting that as that is where our constitutional rights as workers are rooted. And we got to push back on this very conservative body of law that Scalito and others are, you know, pushing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really made me rankle when I read your book. And again, people, I'm talking to Sean Richman. He is the author of Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. It is a brilliant book. It has, it's so readable, and and you learn so much about labor history and also about what's been happening in our generation to American labor. There was a Janus decision in 2018 that it violated free speech for public sector to have to pay union fees. And then you have the Hobby Lobby decision so that they don't have to pay for even the health care of their workers who need contraception. I mean, free speech should be at least equal.
I mean, this is what conservative jurists have done since, you know, since 1866. we put these very progressive notions into the Constitution, and they immediately get turned towards corporate profits. Money talks, right? I mean, that's the bottom line there. The Janus decision is, I find, infuriating. And I write about it a little bit in my book, but also not so much, because I think that unions sort of over-focused on it as an existential threat. And it is, but it's sort of a much longer-term threat. I think, like, no strike clauses and the ban on solidarity activism are much deeper and much more immediate threats. But the Janus decision is insane. I mean, it's just it contradicts itself. It's the decision might as well have read, you know, "Go to hell, we have the votes." Like, there's no legal justification for it. You know, they overturned 40 years of very settled legal precedent, and the free speech right is really flimsy. But again, in this book and in Labor's Bill of Rights, which is an appendix of this book, you know, I've been arguing that we should turn the First Amendment arguments on their head, because we have much stronger First Amendment arguments. Think about, let's just take what a National Labor Relations Board union certification election is. It is an election conducted by an arm of the government, the results of which will determine whether citizens are going to enjoy additional legal protections. The rules of the election, as determined by the government, are that one party, and only one party, can force the voters to attend mandatory meetings where they can lie, they can threaten, and you're fired if you don't go. And crucially, the one party is not just only the employer, but it is only an employer that advocates a no vote. Because if an employer says you should vote for the union, that's also illegal. The union and the workers that want a union have no right to respond. They have no access whatsoever. And when you step back and when you look at it in those terms, how is that not coerced political speech, which is where the Janus decision hangs itself on?
Sean Richman, I hate to stop you there because it doesn't feel like the end. I'm going to try to get you back on KZFR Community Radio's Peace and Justice program, but we have less than a minute. Can you just sign off with something really profoundly important?
I don't know. I mean, this is really tough times. I would say I can't wait till we all get back to work so we can go on strike.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much for being my guest today. Appreciate you very much.
Thank you.
Bye. All right. Stay tuned for Playing Dead. And I want to thank my underwriters for this last half hour of the Peace and Justice program, which would be Quicksilver Courier Service. Established in 2010, Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services. Quicksilver provides courier service for private individuals, as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit ChicoCourier.com or for quality delivery service 24/7. and by Chico Velo, supporting bicycling education and advocacy since 1980. Chico Velo encourages you to ride your bicycle and park it safely at their bicycle valet when available at the Thursday night market and the Saturday farmers market. For more information, visit chicovelo.org and find them on Facebook. And please stay safe, everyone. Ray Lager is here. I'm going to put on a song because I can't get into the board right now, but anyway, I wish you the very best. Hang on.